This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the program, an Australian mother is fighting for her son, who's an Australian citizen, but she claims she can't bring him back from his father in PNG. Also, why people in Papua New Guinea are increasingly using the power of social media to call out bad behaving cops.
The very fact that we are now seeing more and more of these videos is in part an indication that ordinary citizens who are recording these scenes on their camera are trying to take action.
And have more on the fallout from that video that has gone viral in PNG this week, and much more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Graham. First, though, to that story where an Australian woman is facing a difficult battle to bring her young son back to Australia after he went to Papua New Guinea temporarily to live with his father several years ago. The 9-year-old boy was born in Australia and he is an Australian citizen, but he's been living in PNG's capital, Port Moresby, for the last 4 years with his Papua New Guinean father, who the mother claims has refused to send him back to Australia. She says the Australian government's told her that it can't help because PNG isn't a signatory to an international convention that can help return children who are taken overseas by another parent. Liam Fox has the story.
Charmaine Backhouse's voice breaks when she talks about her son, Isaiah.
The innocence of my son has been taken away, and that's what breaks my heart. I had to leave him.
She last saw him in August this year when she travelled to Port Moresby to celebrate his 9th birthday. Isaiah's been living in Port Moresby since 2015, with his father, prominent doctor Duncan Dobunaba, who's the chief anaesthetist at PNG's health department. That was when his parents' 7-year relationship ended, and Ms. Backhouse says they mutually agreed he would temporarily live with his father in Port Moresby while she moved from Brisbane to Broome in Western Australia. She says it was never intended to be a permanent situation, but there is no formal arrangement in place with respect to custody of Isaiah.
Ever since then, I have been over twice. I've kept in contact. I've always begged him to bring him back. And his last famous words is, yes, I will. I'll bring him over. And nothing ever eventuated.
Isaiah was born in Brisbane, is an Australian citizen and has an Australian passport. When he went to stay with his father in 2015, he entered PNG on a dependent visa. That visa expired in April 2016. Dr. Dobunaba said via text message that Ms. Backhouse has not been truthful and that there are always two sides to a story. He said it's not entirely true that he has refused to allow Isaiah to travel to Australia, but declined to comment further. Ms. Backhouse has approached the Australian government for help to bring Isaiah back, but she was told there's little it can do because PNG is not a signatory to what's known as the Hague Convention on the Civil Aspects of International Abduction. That convention provides a process for a child to be returned to their country of habitual residence for custody issues to be dealt with. International family law expert Dr. Danielle Bozen says it can be extremely difficult for a parent to get a child back from a country that has not signed up to the convention.
So essentially they'll have to engage with that country's legal process. This can be logistically and also financially difficult. For example, finding a suitable qualified lawyer and also navigating a foreign legal system that can be informed by quite a different culture and potentially different ideas about what's in a child's best interest.
The Attorney General's Department said it can't comment on specific cases and recommends parents seek legal advice in the concerned country about what options are available. In a statement, it said financial assistance may be available to cover legal costs. After several failed attempts, Ms. Backhouse has now engaged a local lawyer.
I'm extremely nervous because it's their country. It's their country politics that scare me. And because he's such a high-ranking doctor over there and well-known, he's very well-connected. My main goal is for the safety and the well-being of my son.
She's also started an online petition to try and pressure Dr. Dobunaba to send Isaiah back voluntarily.
Liam Fox reporting there. We're staying in PNG, where an investigation into that widely circulated video showing three men being beaten by multiple police is continuing. Well, police authorities have said that the officers involved have been identified and suspended. They're yet to reveal much more about their inquiries. Our reporter Jordan Fennell has been following the story. Jordan, we heard from the acting police commissioner yesterday that he's intending to act swiftly on this, but do we actually know much more today than we did yesterday?
Well, Catherine, the details around when and where the video was filmed are still pretty vague, as is what happened to the victims. We have spoken to Robert Ali, the Director of Internal Affairs at the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary, who said that they have identified culprits in the video, and he says that his officers are currently on top of the matter, but he noted that this situation has damaged the public's trust in the police. Here is a bit of what he had to say.
We are doing everything we can to try to restore, but, you know, this sort of thing, is really killing the morale of the efforts that we are putting in at the moment. And rightly so, yes. It should not be happening. It's really uncalled for. What I'm seeing is a total breakdown in effective supervision. Not supervision per se, no. Effective supervision. The term effective. You can have supervision on the ground, but if you still have discipline problems, then the supervision must be effective.
Jordan, we've seen quite a few people from community members themselves to groups such as the anti-corruption group Transparency International condemning what they've seen in this video. What has Transparency come out and said?
Transparency International PNG have slammed the actions of the police officers and have called the behaviour unacceptable. They say they want to see swift punishment for the officers involved, but they also want to see larger structural change. I spoke with Arian Kasman, the Executive Director of Transparency International PNG, who claimed that at the moment the PNG police lack the resources to do this and that this is an area where Australia could help. The Australian Federal Police has worked alongside the PNG Police for many years and most recently have been providing training and support for their Papua New Guinean counterparts. Here is a bit of what she had to say.
There are opportunities for the support to come from partners such as Australia, such as the Australian Federal Police, but I also strongly believe that, you know, as a country we need to invest in addressing these issues, and the only way for us to do this is to take ownership of these issues and address them as the police hierarchy have said that they will be doing.
So that's Arian Kasman from Transparency International in PNG. What has Australia's Federal Police, the AFP, said to some of those comments and this situation, given they do provide support?
They say that they strongly condemn the use of excessive police force. They also say that they believe an open dialogue with the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary and engagement on the front line is the most effective way to improve policing capabilities, including around human rights and accountability. They say that a fundamental aspect of the partnership between the PNG police and the AFP is respect for international human rights. However, they do say that their role is just in an advisory capacity and they do not exercise any police powers.
Now, we've seen more and more of these types of videos come to light in PNG recently. What does it say about the police culture that exists in Papua New Guinea? And also then the way the community reacts to it.
Yeah, you're definitely right there. We've seen sort of a steady stream of these videos emerge in recent years. I spoke with Sinclair Dinan, an associate professor at the Australian National University's School of Asia Pacific Affairs, who said that the police brutality in PNG has long been known by many, and he calls it a serious and live problem. But he also said that the fact that the community is recording and sharing these videos shows that they want something done about the problem.
The fact that it can occur in such a public way indicates what appears to be a level of impunity on part of those who are partaking in this kind of behaviour. You know, the very fact that we are now seeing more and more of these videos is in part an indication that ordinary citizens who are recording these scenes on their cameras are trying to take action. There's also an indication that in the wider society in PNG, the ordinary citizen is no longer prepared to put up with this kind of action. And that's an additional source of pressure, I think, on the police to change their behaviour.
Thoughts of Sinclair Dinan from the Australian National University, who's done research on policing in PNG, Jordan Fennell reporting.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, debate has broken out after it was revealed that a Cook Islands parliamentary committee is recommending that MPs there criminalise consensual sex between men and also possibly extend it to gay women as well, which would mean that gay people could be sentenced to up to 7 years in prison. Now, this is all just a recommendation at this stage. Parliament would have to debate this and then vote on it early next year. It comes, though, after the Cook Islands signalled 2 years ago that it was going to be getting rid of these types of laws. Now, the head of the committee that's making the recommendation is reported to have said that they've made this recommendation because there is widespread public support to criminalise homosexual acts, but a petition against it has already got thousands of signatures. Valentino Wichman is from the group that represents LGBTQI people in the Cook Islands. She spoke with Pacific Mornings about this just a little while ago. Here's a little of what she had to say.
What people tend to forget is that there are very real, there is a very personal aspect to this argument of decriminalization. And everyone has a family member or friend that is LGBTQI. And, you know, there are real people affected behind this debate. And so my message to our community and our friends and supporters is that message of please don't be scared. The Charity Association is here to help our community. And we just want to spread the message of love, the message of respect, and the message of acceptance, and making sure that everyone in this country is treated equally.
Now, the human rights group Amnesty International is also calling for the laws to be completely dumped. It's described the move as a worrying development and a signal that members of parliament are bowing to pressure. Joel Clark is a campaigner with Amnesty International in Australia. I spoke with him earlier. This is just a recommendation. Parliament would still need to debate it and then sign off on any changes. We understand the Prime Minister's office in Cook Islands says that a lot of these concerns we're seeing, the petition, etc., may all be a bit premature. So why are you so worried at Amnesty about this? What do you think the risk might be?
The reason why Amnesty is so worried about this is because 2 years ago, the Cook Islands made great progress by finally effectively decriminalising homosexuality. Within those 2 years, though, there has been a concerted campaign effort to wind back those laws. And this signal from the committee is exactly that. It is a signal that members of parliament are bowing to the pressure of church groups and other groups that are classifying homosexuality alongside things like witchcraft and criminalising them. This is obviously an extremely worrying development, and any efforts to stop that from progressing is extremely important.
Well, you've mentioned there, and you claim that politicians look like they might be bowing to the pressure of church groups, and it is reported that there is apparently wide public support for these changes. I want to put to you the fact that the argument might be that someone's right to their religious views and beliefs also need to be considered. If this is something that people who are religious believe in strongly and are the majority of the population, why shouldn't their views be considered?
Religious freedom doesn't extend to the criminalisation of certain acts. Particularly what we're seeing in this is a 7-year sentence for consensual same-sex relationships. This obviously does not fall under protections under freedom of religion. The Cook Islands is bowing to what politicians call public pressure, but compliance with international law and the upholding of human rights is not a popularity contest. The Cook Islands, in their own constitution, protect non-discrimination and equality before the law. This is obviously not in line with that at all and should be reversed.
You mentioned there the 7-year sentence. It has been explained by the head of this parliamentary committee that no one has been prosecuted so far and they don't think that people would be. Do you think that's a fair argument?
No, that's not a fair argument. Just because people aren't being punished under archaic and wrong laws doesn't mean that it should remain on the books. And what's incredibly concerning about this recommendation and the technicalities around this recommendation is that it is possible that for the first time this law will even be extended. Currently, women are not caught under the criminalisation of homosexuality, and there are real concerns that women in same-sex relationships could now be sentenced under this new recommendation also.
It is often argued or discussed, not just in Cook Islands, but in other Pacific nations when these sorts of issues do come to light, that there are, other than the religious factors, there are also cultural implications here for these Pacific Island nations, and that they are communities with different beliefs and values than we might have in Australia or New Zealand, for example. I mean, is that something that Amnesty needs to take into consideration when you come out so strongly as you do, aware obviously that you are advocating for human rights, but there's also got to be that issue of the cultural aspects as well?
Cultural aspects definitely need to be taken into account, but human rights are universal. Everyone is born with and possesses the same rights, regardless of where they live, the gender, religion, culture, or ethnic background. And this is what Amnesty is saying in this instance, is that the LGBTQI community in the Cook Islands have the right to live the life the way that they were born to and that they want to. This law will negate that, and it should be reversed.
Also, Joel Clark, a campaigner with Amnesty International. We have requested comments from both the head of the parliamentary committee making the recommendation, also the office of the Prime Minister. We're yet to get a response. Well, Fiji's record on how it deals with violence against women, as well as things like people's freedom of expression, climate change and other issues, were all laid out for the whole world to see just a few hours ago when they took to the floor at the UN Human Rights Council. As we heard on the program yesterday, Fiji's had its third review of its human rights record. It's where other UN member states get a chance to suggest where they might be able to improve, and the nation in question, in this case Fiji, gets a chance to put forward its case. For more on this, I'm joined by Pacific Beat reporter Nick Fogarty. Nick, tell us how this meeting played out.
Well, Fiji's delegation, led by the country's Chief Justice Kamal Kumar, went to Geneva to present its report in front of the UN and 97 of its member states. It was a long meeting, more than 3 hours, and it might just seem like a whole lot of talking, but at the end of the day, its purpose is for all the nations of the world to get in a room together with their eyes on Fiji, or whichever nation is in the hot seat, and for Fiji to say, we've done X, Y, and Z to improve in this area of universal human rights, but we think we could do better in this area. And then every other nation gets a couple of minutes to suggest from their observations which areas they think Fiji could do better in. Three countries are chosen to report on the findings of the review, which they'll present in a few days. And then everyone goes away with a much better idea of that country's human rights situation. And the country ideally feels that global pressure to improve.
All right. So what were some of the issues that were highlighted for Fiji or by Fiji and other countries there?
So Fiji had a number of speakers, including their permanent representative to the UN in Geneva, Ambassador Nazat Shamim Khan. Now, Ms. Khan spoke about how since their last UN review in 2014, Fiji's ratified all 9 core human rights treaties and conventions. They've abolished the death penalty. They've included human rights in their climate change policies. And they're tackling what she says is one of Fiji's greatest challenges, which is to reduce sexual and gender-based violence in Fiji by rooting out patriarchal attitudes towards women and girls. Those were the key points made by Fiji.
So points she obviously wanted to talk up as positive changes. But one of the recent developments that we've seen in Fiji that has caused a bit of concern for human rights watchers there has been the introduction of what's called the Online Safety Act. Now, the government says it's designed to stop harassment on social media. But what did Fiji's delegation have to say about it?
Well, they certainly did raise it. And as you say, the new legislation has been picked apart a bit by some observers who say that it could lead to the censorship of free speech. For instance, it was reported that the Pacific Freedom Forum said it would muzzle rather than protect Fiji's citizens. Here's what Fiji's permanent representative to the UN, Nazat Shamim Khan, had to say about the intersection of media freedom and online safety.
Section 17 of the Constitution declares that freedom of expression is a right in Fiji, but it specifically deals with protection of media freedom. And because the way in which the Constitution is interpreted must be interpreted in line with international law and practices, very important that freedom of expression will also be so interpreted by the courts. We have, however, had in relation to the social media, disturbing incidents where people have been specifically targeted because of their gender, because of their race, because of their religion. And in response to the concern about increasing numbers of incitement and of harassment and bullying, as far as social media posts are concerned, government has passed the Online Safety Act, which is intended to protect citizens from exploitation, harassment and violence online.
That's Nazat Shamim Khan, who's Fiji's permanent representative to the UN in Geneva, and just one of the aspects of the country's human rights record that was discussed. And one of the recommendations made by the United States at this meeting was actually that Fiji make sure it safeguards free expression by ensuring that criminal legislation is not misused to suppress the media, civil society and opposition politicians' criticism of the government. Just briefly, some of the other comments made to Fiji by other nations. Australia recommended that Fiji continue its efforts to address violence against women and children, and China recommended that they continue to promote sustainable economic and social development. So as I mentioned, in a few days, the full report into Fiji's review will be released, and then we'll have a better idea of the opinions of the UN's member states into what they actually think of Fiji's human rights record over the last 5 years.
So reporter Nick Fogarty. We've probably heard of Bitcoin, but have you heard of Libra? You should have. We reported on it a few months ago. It's a cryptocurrency that the social media giant Facebook is planning to launch. Now, at the time, we were asking whether having a currency that's linked to such a popular social media site could actually make it easier and a more efficient way for people in overseas Pacific communities to send money home. But the thing is, the cryptocurrency is yet to be released. It's already facing major hurdles. Earlier this month, PayPal, Visa and MasterCard all backed out of the digital currency. Oliver Gordon explains.
It's supposed to rival Bitcoin. It's called Libra and it's Facebook's attempt to get into digital currency. Vanessa Teague is an expert on cryptocurrency.
Libra is a kind of cryptocurrency, but it's somewhat different from the anarchic blockchain-based cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. It's organised and secured by a group of corporations that are responsible for maintaining the transaction history.
The corporations responsible for Libra's administration are led by Facebook, which is facing major hurdles getting its digital currency over the line, both abroad and in Australia. Last month, financial regulators, including ASIC, the ACCC, and the Office of the Information Commissioner, met with Facebook to see if the social media giant could answer its questions about the privacy and security of its proposed new currency. The group was left unsatisfied, and last night, a spokesperson for the Office for the Information Commissioner released the following statement.
We remain concerned that Facebook and Calibra have only made broad public statements about privacy and have not addressed the information handling practices that will be in place to secure and protect personal information.
In the wake of the meeting, the group of financial regulators struck a deal to work together to probe Facebook on the security and privacy concerns they have about Libra. The move to interrogate Facebook is set against a backdrop of corporate regulators getting tough on online operators, with the ACCC taking Google to court on data breaches. Melbourne University's Vanessa Teague says when it comes to Libra, the regulators' concerns are twofold.
First of all, they're concerned about money laundering and the possibility of doing very large transactions under the radar. And secondly, they're concerned about the privacy implications.
The digital currency expert believes one of their concerns is more valid than the other.
The money laundering concern is actually less of a problem than I think they think it's going to be, but the privacy implications are huge. At the moment, it's actually quite hard for them to figure out what stuff you bought. It's easy for them to figure out what websites you clicked on, what ads you clicked on, but at the moment they don't really have that last critical piece of information about how you actually spent your money. So Libra gives them the opportunity to expand their surveillance system to the very last step in the selling stuff process.
Facebook is a global company, and the concerns shared by Australian regulators and experts are being reflected around the world. 2 weeks ago, Mark Zuckerberg faced a hostile House Financial Services Committee in Washington.
I actually don't know if Libra is going to work, but I believe that it's important to try new things.
The Facebook founders' appeals were generally met with scepticism, and with international groups such as the G20 and the International Organization of Securities Commissions also publicly raising concerns about the Libra, it's unlikely you'll be purchasing your morning coffee through your Facebook profile anytime soon.
It's Oliver Gordon reporting there. That's all for Pacific Beat this morning. Don't forget, though, if you want to listen back to our stories, you can do so via our website. The entire program is there, and also individual stories are there as well. And you can, of course, follow us on Facebook. Just find and like ABC Radio Australia's Facebook page.